episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
And what do you have for us, Bill?
Well, we have a sponsor this hour. This hour's sponsor is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape is everything John Deere. You want a tractor, you want a mower, you want implements, you want parts, service, they got it all. Go up and see them. They're 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. Or give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. Or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
And they also have these really cool little handheld chainsaws.
Oh, yeah.
Steel, right?
Handiest pruning gadget you ever used.
Yeah, so while you're cutting all your crepe myrtles and all that stuff and you're using your ratchet pruner and your hands feel like they're going to fall off, you'd run down there and get one of those little, it's like a, what, 4-inch little?
I think it's got like a 6-inch chainsaw on it. Yeah.
It's like a little chainsaw you can hold in one hand.
Yeah.
Spectacular tool.
Zippity-doo-dah with that thing.
Huh? You'll cut things that you didn't even want to cut just so you can cut more stuff. Oh, maybe that's just me.
Yeah, it's easy to over-prune with one of those.
That just might be me. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So what do we got going on today?
Okay, so today we are chatting with Bruce Sackman, who is on the phone. I was just, I was doing the universal signal of, he's on the phone, right? Tyler gave me the thumbs up, so we're good. Boy, I tell you, just full disclosure, we tried to do this a few weeks ago, and then Mr. Sackman was traveling, and then we tried to do it again, but it was Thanksgiving weekend, and we had no engineer. So this is the third try. And it is the third, and it's 3 o'clock where he lives.
It's the charm.
So you know what? It was the triple three. We were definitely going to make this happen. Because when we spoke with him, we've done a couple of shows with him. He has a website called BehindTheMurderCurtain.com. So just in case you've been listening to politics all morning and you're thinking, oh, please, somebody talk about something besides, like, the Hamas war or George Santos or, like, whatever other, you know, and they're all important, but good grief. It just, after a while, every time you turn the channel, it's the same thing. So we thought we would help you. Mr. Sackman served as a special agent in charge for the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs in the Office of the Inspector General. He was in the Criminal Investigations Division in the Northeast Field Office until May 2005, when he retired after 32 years of service. In that capacity, he was responsible for all major criminal investigations involving VA from West Virginia to Maine. During his tenure, he was involved in hundreds of investigations involving allegations of fraud, corruption, false claims, thefts, patient assaults, pharmaceutical drug diversions, and suspicious hospital deaths, which is where those other shows came in. He was also responsible for supervising the successful investigation of the nation's first homicide conviction in connection with pharmaceutical research. His cases involving medical professionals who have murdered their patients have been featured on the Discovery Health Channel, CNN, MSNBC, America's Most Wanted, and on HBO. He's the recipient of many awards for his investigations and for his efforts in encouraging the profession of forensic nursing. Mr. Sackman has lectured at several forensic-related conferences, state police organizations, the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, universities, and medical-related symposia. He's the author of the book, Behind the Murder Curtain. Special Agent Bruce Sackman hunts doctors and nurses who kill our veterans, and the article, When the ICU Becomes a Crime Scene, for Critical Care Nursing Quarterly. And the first couple of shows, did I link them correctly? I did not. I will put them on the page. So today is December the 3rd, 2023. And I will attach those other two shows so you can find them quickly. Otherwise, you can just go to the archive. But today's show, we called it The Role of Hospital Management in Covering for Criminal Physicians and Nurses. Because he's got like a long history there. First one was a medical serial killer, just to do a little spoiler alert. And the guy he was chasing had a terrific name. I'm not even going to do it because Robert just got here and he'll become convulsed laughing. He can't handle it when we talk about 00 Swango. Best name for a killer ever. Terrible person, but funny name. Mr. Sackman, how the heck is Florida treating you right now? Probably sunnier than it is here. Uh-oh. Seeing the cone of silence?
I think we might have lost him, so let's try to call him back.
Oh, my God. I did the longest introduction in the universe.
And then he's not even there, so I'll try to get him back on the line.
Yeah.
Guys.
So much for my third show on the third. The three
See,
o'clock.
That you jinxed it, man.
I did.
All right, I'll call him back. I'll call him
Please
back.
Please do. All Speedy. Right. I'll tell you more about the book then. Behind the Murder Curtains, the true story of Bruce Sackman, special agent in charge of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Main responsibilities were investigating white-collar crimes, such as embezzlement, when he was drawn into a macabre world of doctors and nurses who murder their patients. He evolved from an investigator of routine cases to the world's leading expert on medical serial killers. And I don't know. Who the heck knows anything about medical serial killers? I mean, we had never really heard about that. But I have a friend in Philadelphia who's a whistleblower with VA. She actually works for VA, but she's a concurrent whistleblower, it seems like, forever. And she had said, oh, you got to interview this guy. So, super interesting shows.
Yeah, it happens a lot more than you think.
It looks like we got Mr. Bruce back on the line.
Mr. Sackman. Well, I was doing the longest intro known to man, and then we somehow got... I don't know. Disconnected. Welcome back.
He's on the line.
Are the words welcome back the problem?
I do not know.
Hi, how's it going? Is that better? No, not better. Still not netting any result there. Classic. Classic. So, Robert, how's it been going with you? Bill, anything to add? Do I have to hum the Jeopardy song again?
Pape Machinery is our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer.
Bill gets the One Trick Pony Award. You know, that's why live radio is so much fun. Like, people do all these podcasts where they pre-record. Maybe those are live, too. I don't know. Okay, I don't know anything about podcasts. I should just stop talking.
Guess what? This is the third time. I think this is the charm.
Yes.
Here we go.
Yes.
All right. Bruce, are you there?
There we go. See, your three's worked.
All right.
Oh, my gosh.
There's a lot of phone line between here and Florida.
Third show on the third at 3 o'clock. Three times we called him. Wow. What else? Oh, my gosh. So, Mr. Sackman, how's the world treating you?
It's treating me pretty well.
Oh, that long pause there had me going. Well. Every time I asked you that before you were disconnected, I'm like, oh, God, I should stop asking that question. It's me. I'm doing it.
Oh, no, everything is fine. Everything's great. Thank you. And I hope everything's well with you and your family as well.
Yeah. We all survived Thanksgiving. I think... you know, everybody kind of looks forward to that, and then it shows up, and there's it's kind of a rat race, and then it's over, and it's like, oh, now it's all about Bill obsessing about putting up lights.
No,
yeah.
Not.
Yeah, he wants to make another trip to Home Depot. Just spoiler alert.
I've gone to therapy for that.
Home Depot, Bill's coming back.
No.
I'm like, he's hooked on Christmas trees and wreaths this year. Used to be lights.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we'd have like 30,000 lights. It looked like the Walmart distribution center out in our front yard. I mean, you could see it from space. I'm positive you could. We had an 8-foot star, 6-foot star?
It was 6 foot. It was just a little one.
Oh, yeah. It wasn't 8. It was 6. Way up in an oak tree that you could see from about a mile out till a huge storm came, ripped the top of the tree off. That was the end of that. Oh, my gosh. Well, all right. So that's the moment of levity. Now we move directly into murder. I guess that's all the fun we're going to have. So I was kind of, you know, in the... during the disconnection era areas, I was going through the longer version of your bio and talking about all these investigations and how you were really the first person to discover this idea of medical serial killers. And so when I asked you about doing a different show, and you know, another one on another topic, and you said the role of hospital management covering for criminal physicians and nurses, is this stuff you learned after or before? like the medical serial killer part, or was it all part and parcel?
I would say during and after, because it hasn't ended. I mean, I'm going to talk about some cases that were recently in the news.
Oh, all right.
Some terrible, terrible situations, not involving murder, but involving sexual assault, and the role of management in covering up physicians who were criminally prosecuted for this. And the number of victims is just horrendous. The role of the medical management was just terrible, and we'll talk about that in great detail today.
All right. Well, you take it away with wherever you would like to start, and we'll just follow along over here.
All right. Whenever you're ready.
Yep. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, good afternoon, everyone, and I'm very happy to be here. And unfortunately, after, well, some 30 years of being involved in cases where doctors and nurses have murdered their patients, I regret to say that these cases are still ongoing right now as we speak, and that apparently we haven't really learned enough on how to stop these cases. And perhaps more depressing is that the role of management in covering up these cases, whether it be medical serial killers or really bad physicians, has not really changed at all. And there are some very, very recent cases, some of them just incredible to even speak about, where management has continued to cover for the physician or for the nurse that was eventually convicted of either murdering or sexually assaulting a number of patients. And perhaps you've heard about the horrendous case at Columbia Hospital in New York City. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with Columbia Presbyterian. It is one of the most prestigious hospitals in the country. I mean, it's really an outstanding hospital. In fact, when the president is in town, God forbid, if he should take ill or something terrible should happen, they would bring him to Columbia Presbyterian. So that's how good that hospital is. And in that hospital, there was an OBGYN by the name of Dr. Hodden, H-A-D-D-E-N. Now, Dr. Hodden was an OBGYN for about 20 years. And he sexually assaulted a number of patients. Well, what is the number of patients? Are we talking about 1, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 50,
oh my God.
100, 150, 200? How about 245?
Wow.
245 patients were sexually assaulted by Dr. Hatton over a period of 20 years. So how did this all begin? Well, one of his patients was on the examining table, and she realized that Dr. Hodden had extended his tongue into her vagina, and that really freaked her out, as you could imagine.
Yeah, I just threw up in my mouth a little bit.
You know, so she went home, and she told her boyfriend, and they went to the police, and the police arrested Dr. Hodden. They did a good job. They arrested Dr. Hodden on a Friday. On Monday, he was back in the office seeing patients. What?
Yeah, no kidding.
He was back in the office seeing patients. You see, for the hospital management, Dr. Hannon was a very popular doctor. I mean, he had thousands and thousands of patients. He brought in a lot of money to the hospital. And look, after all, these are only allegations, you know, from one patient. But when you go into the files of Columbia, you see that they had actually had other patients come forward by letter, but they just kind of filed that away. They put that away. They kind of forgot about it, okay? And now they had the situation where Dr. Hannon's actually arrested in his office in front of the patients. Well, that didn't stop them from bringing him back in on the following Monday.
No, but they had
they had this great idea. You see, they had this great idea. They sent him a letter and they said, look, you know, doctor, because of these allegations, you could continue practice, but we want to have a chaperone, you know, somebody else in the examining room with you. Well, sometimes that other person in the examining room had to walk out. You know, they had to go to the bathroom. They had something else to do.
And they couldn't put the Hannibal Lecter mask on him or anything?
Yeah. And guess what happened? He sexually assaulted a patient the first day he returned to work after being arrested by the NYPD.
Oh, my God. I guess that's what you call a truly habitual offender. All right, Bruce, hold on five seconds on that heinous note. We have to take a really quick break.
Of course.
Hopefully the commercials are cheerful. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Yeah, gosh, I haven't heard that song in a while, but, you know, are you crazy or are you high? That's probably what the management was wondering. It's got to be what the patients were wondering. All right, so Bruce, back to Dr.
H-A-D-D-E-N.
Yeah, sorry, I had a whole different name that I felt was probably inappropriate for me to blurt out.
So when the NYPD did their investigation and sent out subpoenas and all, do you think the hospital was forthcoming? Well, do you think the hospital was fighting them tooth and nail? I'll give you two guesses.
Okay.
All right. In fact, the hospital never disclosed that prior to this arrest, and this one woman that had the courage to come forward to the NYPD, that they had heard about this before. They had received correspondence about him before, but they did absolutely nothing.
Oh, my God.
So finally, the New York City District Attorney's Office enters into a plea agreement with Dr. Haddon, and for no jail time. But he has to give up his practice. And do you think that the hospital notified all of his patients, which is, by the way, 6,500 patients over 20 years?
Whoa.
Do you think they sent something out notifying them about what happened, being forthright? Nope. Not a word. No word at all. Well, you know, what happened is that the victims, they got attorneys, and many, many civil suits were filed. And it cost the hospital hundreds of millions of dollars in civil settlements. But did any of the managers actually lose their job? Well, the president of the institution retired. But did any of the managers, anybody involved in covering this up, in not assisting the NYPD, in not helping the victims, were any of them prosecuted? Did any of them lose their jobs? Nope. So what kind of incentive does that give managers out there when situations like this arise? Okay? I mean, we all heard about that Dr. Larry Nassar. Remember him when all the gymnasts that he sexually assaulted? Oh, Dr. Nassar went to prison.
Yeah.
But did anybody in any of the organizations that knew what was going on, that covered up, that didn't cooperate, were any of them prosecuted? No. And let's talk about our medical serial killers, okay? Lucy Letby. She was in the news a lot, just to remind people. She was a nurse in England that murdered a number of newborn babies. Remember her?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she was something else, that one. She actually was convicted on 8 counts of murder and 10 counts of attempted murder of newborns. And whistleblowers went to management, and they told management of their suspicions. And management turned around and said, no, we disagree. In fact, we are ordering you to go apologize to Lucy Letby for even making these allegations against her. Yeah. So they were actually ordered to apologize for making allegations against this nurse who was eventually convicted of murdering a number of patients. You know, there's this whole thing where we'll let the person keep working, but maybe we'll assign somebody to them. That never works. There was a case at a VA hospital in Columbia, Missouri, of Richard Williams. He was a nurse, allegedly killed a number of our nation's heroes. And a number of brave whistleblowers came forward to management, and they said, you know, we believe, and they laid out their case, why they thought Richard Williams was murdering patients. Murdering patients. And management said, well, I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to assign another nurse to work with Richard Williams. And when that other nurse was with Richard Williams, yeah, nobody died. But when that nurse had to take a day off, had to run out, had to do something, guess what happened? That's when patients died. Unexpectedly. Now, I'm unaware of any successful prosecution, criminal prosecution, of any hospital manager anywhere for aiding and abetting, whether it be these murders or these sexual assaults. Now, it was tried. It was tried in Germany. In Germany, there was a medical serial killer, a nurse by the name of Niles Hogel. Niles Hogel killed so many people he can't even remember. You know, he admitted to killing over 100 patients. But the German police think he killed closer to about 300 patients. You know, he killed so many people. Hey, you can't expect them to remember. He killed so many people, you know, you can't expect them to remember.
Jeez.
So the German prosecutors, they actually charged managers in the hospital with aiding and abetting the murders. Why? Because this is what happened, and this has happened all over the country. And I'll speak about a few other cases here in the United States where it's happened. You see, when Niles Hogel worked in Hospital 1, they suspected something. Sometimes they did a pretty good internal investigation. And they were pretty sure that Niles Hogel was responsible for the death of patients. But you know what? Niles Hogel left. He found the job somewhere else. Well, Hospital 1 said, that's enough for us. We don't have to call the police. We don't have to do anything. Niles Hogel is out of our hair. And then he goes to Hospital 2, and the same thing happens. And in Hospital 3, the same thing happens. All right. So if you're in management and you conduct an internal investigation and you have more than reasonable suspicion that a medical professional is harming patients, whether it be murder or assault, whatever, and you say nothing and do nothing and allow this person to go on to the next facility and kill, shouldn't you be charged with a crime?
They
tried it in Germany.
Twice.
They tried it in Germany, and it did not work.
Wow.
And probably one of the most famous cases here in the United States is the case of a fellow named Cullen, Nurse Cullen. You know, there was a show on TV called The Good Nurse, and there's actually a book by that name. It's an excellent book, by the way. And Charles Cullen was a nurse that murdered patients, and he started out in Pennsylvania, and he wound up in Jersey. And when Hospital 1 suspected something, they never said anything to Hospital 2. They never said anything to Hospital 3. never said anything to hospital four, and never said anything to hospital five, or six, or seven, or eight, or nine. Finally, hospital 10, a brave whistleblower came forward and said something. All right. But did anything happen to any of these managers in any of these facilities? No. Nothing happened at all. Oh, yeah. Sometimes the hospital gets fined, but that doesn't come out of the manager's pocket. The hospitals are never charged criminally, and certainly the managers are never charged criminally. So what kind of incentive, if you're a manager, your financial incentive is to do everything you can, in your opinion anyway, to hide these issues to what you think is protecting the reputation of the hospital? That's your number one concern. Not about the patients.
Not the patients.
not the victims. Oh, no, not at all. Your number one responsibility, especially if you want to keep your job, your number one responsibility is to the bottom line of the hospital. You know, there was a hospital in New Jersey many years ago where one doctor was murdering the patients of another doctor. He wanted to eliminate the competition. Well, this was a big trial.
You're short on sick
people. It lasted for a long time. And you know what? That hospital eventually had to go out of business. They changed their name three times, and they still had to go out of business. So you know what, nurse whistleblower or doctor whistleblower? Do you want that to happen in our hospital? Do you want everybody here to lose our job? Do you want the hospital to close? Look, this nurse, this doctor went on to another hospital. Just be quiet. Keep your mouth shut. Don't say anything. Nothing's going to happen to you for not saying anything. Nothing at all.
Except to go to hell, but, you know, that's later, so I guess why worry about that?
Exactly. Mm. So, you know what? It's very interesting when we talk about how all these cases are developed. Of course, the case with Dr. Hannon came about from the patients, these poor ladies, and there are so many, and we don't even know if 250 is the final number. Who the hell knows? I mean, he saw 6,500 patients. Why did he only sexually assault 250? We don't even know what the bottom line is. But one thing we know that the hospital management covered it up.
How do you, I mean, honestly, how do you rationalize that, that you covered up that many criminal acts? I mean, at some point, I don't know, we don't have much, you know, newspaper type, you know, investigative reporting, but didn't somebody get a hold of that and publicize it?
Yeah, actually they did. And ProPublica published a lot of that, and eventually all the other newspapers picked up on it. But how many victims do we have to have before something happens, all right?
Yeah, because one was enough for all of us. Here, we just took a survey. There's four of us. We all decided, yeah, one was enough.
Yeah, I would say so, right? One was enough. If nothing else, and look, sometimes I've investigated cases where patients alleged sexual assault and it wasn't true, but I could tell you what happened. The doctor was immediately taken off of patient care, immediately, and not returned to patient care until we were collectively satisfied that the allegations were untrue. All right. Because anybody can make an allegation at any time. But when you have these, especially numerous allegations like this, could you imagine you're the hospital director, one of your OBGYN gets arrested by the NYPD for sexual assault, and as soon as he gets out of jail that Monday, you put him back in patient care? Can you imagine doing such a thing like that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I sound angry, I am angry, because I have seen this so many times throughout the world, and things don't seem to change. And they're not going to change until a couple of things happen. Number one, we need a prosecutor. And look, you know, we've seen how aggressive prosecutors could be, particularly when it comes to the election laws, all right? We've seen how aggressive they could be. How about being that aggressive against managers who allow these crimes to occur?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like to see some of that aggression. I mean, you know, it's okay when it's a political crime, but what about when there are hundreds of victims, and nothing happens with management? Look, we've seen this with the pharmaceutical companies, right?
Yeah.
With oxycodone, with the Statler family. Oh, yeah, they have to pay billions of dollars in fines. And that's terrific. But how about sending somebody to jail when hundreds of thousands of people die and you knew what you were doing was wrong, but nobody goes to jail? So this is what we have to do. First thing we have to do, if the existing laws, and I'm not sure if this is true, but if the existing laws don't allow for the prosecution of these managers, then we have to change the law. Then we just have to change the law and make it a crime. So prosecutors won't have an excuse. Well, I don't know if it's really aiding and abetting. I don't know about this. And besides, they're paying so much money, so why don't we just move on? Well, I don't really want to hear that ever again. And the next thing we have to do is we have to incentivize our whistleblowers. And I'll give you an example of what I mean. If you blow the whistle on financial fraud against the government, there's something called a QI-TAM suit. And this is what a QI-TAM suit is. It means he who sues on behalf of the government, and actually he who sues on behalf of the king and himself. It goes back to English common law. And this is the way it works. If you're working for a firm that has a government contract or receiving government money, like a hospital, and you're aware that they're committing some kind of fraud against the government, we're just talking fraud now, right? Fraud against the government. You get a hold of an attorney and you file what's called a QI-TAM suit. It's known as a whistleblower suit, a secret lawsuit. See, it goes into federal court and you lay out all your allegations, and then the government has the option of doing a criminal investigation, a civil investigation, or no investigation at all. And if the government does an investigation and recovers money, you're entitled to a percentage of all the money that was recovered, plus legal fees. It's a wonderful thing for investigators. It's a great gift to investigators. When I was on the job, I had 7 QI-TAM cases ongoing at once. It was a great gift. But if you're a nurse or a doctor, and you report how another nurse or doctor is harming patients, and there are big civil suits and civil settlements, you don't get a dime. There's no reward for that. You know what the reward is? The reward is keeping your mouth shut.
I was going to say, the reward
is keeping your job.
Shut up or get
that's
fired.
That's the reward. Yeah?
Yeah,
wow.
That's
the reward.
Yeah, there's really no protection. If they do speak out, I mean, yeah, they have whistleblower laws, but I think we all know.
But that's different. That's a whole different arena. Bruce, when we come back, talk more about that, the different kinds of whistleblowers and different sorts of things, because people think if they just speak out that they then are a whistleblower, and I keep trying to explain to people, it's a process. Our guest
is it is a process, and there are some wonderful, if there are any potential whistleblowers out there before you blow the whistle, I would advise you to contact a number of organizations. There's one, I think it's called Whistleblowers of America.
Yep, we've had them on.
Yeah, and they will guide you on what to do and how to do it, because it could be a very slippery slope.
Yeah, you go
Nurse
from...
Aaron, I want to ask you a question, Nurse Aaron. You know,
yeah.
You're making these allegations against Dr. Bruce here. Did you actually see Dr. Bruce harm anybody? Well, you didn't actually see him harm anybody, but, you know, you have reason to believe this. Well, I want to just kind of caution you here, Nurse, that, you know, when you make these allegations, well, you're sort of under investigation yourself, you know? So, I mean, like, is all your training up to snuff? Is all your license and everything kosher? I mean, if I drug tested you today, are you going to drug test positive? You know, I only ask you this for your own protection, Nurse.
Yeah.
just trying to help.
Trying to help you.
Yeah, just trying to help you So, you sure you still want to pursue this? Because if you do, then you might have to testify, and then your background and everything comes into play. You know, I had this case.
Hold that thought, Bruce. We have to take a really quick break.
Sure.
God, we just need to get rid of all the commercials so we can just talk to them for hours. All right. So I was thinking back to the nurse that was killing the babies, and I found a song I thought was fitting. So anyway, I thought we should play it in her honor, maybe. I don't know. It's kind of a weird word.
Probably not honor.
Didn't have anything good there. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Stay away. Look out.
Be Michael Swango. I knew I'd Dick Robert down with that one. Okay, so
the whistleblower.
We were talking about whistleblowers.
Yeah, Whistleblowers of America, good organization, lots of info. Do you have some others that you would recommend?
That's the one that I am most familiar with. Okay. I actually spoke at one of their events, but let's just say a few words about a whistleblower and whistleblowing. You know, it takes a lot of courage to be a whistleblower. And I'll give you an example of some courage. I'll give you a couple examples. One, a number of years ago, there was an article in the New York Times, and it was entitled, "Nurses Criminally Prosecuted for Alleging Physician Wrongdoing." What? Now, I didn't think in the United States of America you could be criminally prosecuted for being a whistleblower.
No kidding.
Oh, I was wrong. I was wrong. You see, there's a place called Kermit, Texas. And Kermit, Texas is in the permanent oil basin in Texas. And it's very hard to find doctors and nurses in a place like that. You know, a lot of people just don't want to resign there. So these two nurses, who happened to be the entire compliance department, they went to management alleging that this physician was harming patients. And management's response was, "What, are you kidding me? Do you know how hard it is to find doctors in Kermit, Texas? Why, we have to go all the way to the Philippines or all the way to Ireland. So you know what? We're lucky we have a doctor here. So you know what, nurses? Just keep your mouth shut.
We're lucky to have a doctor, even though he's killing everybody. That makes a lot of sense.
And just be happy you have a job." So these nurses said, "Well, what the hell do we do now?" And one nurse said, "I have an idea. Let's send an anonymous letter to the Texas State Medical Board about this doctor, all right?" Well, the doctor gets wind of it, and boy, is he pissed. So he calls the local sheriff, who happened to be one of his patients, the sheriff, Robert Roberts, and he says, "Sheriff Roberts, I think these women are intentionally harming my reputation. Do something about it." And the sheriff says, "Don't worry, Doc, I'm on the case." And he gets a search warrant to through their hospital computers.
Oh.
And he discovers that they are the authors of the anonymous letter, the state medical board. He actually has them arrested and charged with misuse of official information, which is a felony in those parts. Well, these nurses get fired. They have to, the hospital does not defend them. They defend the doctor. They have to get their own attorneys, and they wind up in court. And the jury is out for about 20 minutes, and they come back and they say, are you kidding me? These nurses deserve a medal for what they did, not to be criminally prosecuted. Oh, yeah, and they won their case, and they got money. But, you know, what kind of message did that send out to other nurses out there who were considering whistleblowing? Hey, did you hear about those two nurses in Texas? Did you hear what happened to them? Oh, yeah, they eventually won. Do you want to go through all that? Do you want to be arrested? Do you want to go to trial and hope that you win? So, you know what? I don't think so. I think it's best if we just quietly go on with our jobs and not say anything. In the Nurse Kristen Gilbert case, if you remember Nurse Kristen Gilbert, she was convicted of killing a number of our nation's heroes at the Northampton VA Medical Center. And how did we find out about it? Well, not through management. I know that's not going to come as a surprise to you. We found out about it. You know, we found out about it from some nurse whistleblowers who were very, very courageous, who went to management. Management poo-pooed what they said, and they came to my office. But you know what? These whistleblowers, they're human beings. They have issues. Some of them had drug problems. Some of them had other issues. Stuff that is very, very embarrassing that you have to reveal in court. But you know what? They were so courageous that when we went to trial, they had to disclose their human frailties. They had to disclose their own issues when they were testifying against Kristen Gilbert. Well, she was convicted of murdering a number of our patients, a number of our nation's heroes at the Northampton VA Medical Center. And when the whistleblowers returned to work, you think they were greeted as heroes? Nope. Just the opposite. Their coworkers would say to them, what the heck did you do? You know, this hospital used to have the best reputation. People used to drive by this VA hospital and say, what an excellent hospital that is. Now, you know what they say? I wouldn't go there. That's where that serial killer, Kristen Gilbert, worked. We hate you for what you did, Nurse Whistleblower. This is the reality of the situation.
And that just makes no sense.
One of the reasons,
it does happen, though.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons why my medical serial killers or medical serial sexual assault physicians get away with killing or harming so many people. All right? Because the whistleblowers are afraid to come forth. Management does nothing. You know, your average, if there is such an average, I don't know, serial killer maybe kills 6 or 7 people. Well, they're amateurs compared to my medical serial killer. The average kills somewhere between 30 and 60. I mean, we talked about Niles Hogel, who killed over 100. Harold Shipman in England killed 300 people. Swango, maybe 60 people. Nurse Cullen, maybe 60. You know, they kill so many people. They can't remember themselves how many people they kill. But why do we have to have so many victims, whether it be these sexual assault cases or these actual murders? Why do we have to have so many victims until something happens? And in my opinion, until the system changes, until we start prosecuting managers and doing better protection of our whistleblowers, we'll have this conversation a couple of times a year.
Why do you think it's so difficult to prosecute a hospital manager when the evidence is so strong that they, you know, pass these people over to other hospitals and so forth? Why is it so hard to prosecute them?
Yeah.
You know, That is an excellent, excellent question. And I could tell you what I usually hear from the prosecutors. That it's not really sufficient evidence to prove that they aided and abetted these murders. All right? And that the law is such, and I'm not an attorney, but the law is such that it makes it difficult for the prosecutors to go forth on charges like that. And if that's true, I don't know if it is, but if it is true, then let's change the law.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah, absolutely.
Let's change the law. So then they won't have that excuse. So I won't hear anymore, well, Bruce, you know, I understand what you're saying, but we really not confident that we could prove this. And they say, look, remember in Germany, they tried it in Germany, it didn't work in Germany. Well, the law in Germany is different. I don't really know the law in Germany. But I can tell you this, if that's the case, and it may well be, well, then the simple solution is to change the law, because until you hold management, corporate executives, whether it be a pharmaceutical company, whether it be a hospital management, a nursing home management, until you hold these people criminally liable, there's no incentive for them to cooperate. There's no incentive for them to call the police. There's no incentive for them to disclose all their internal investigation, even under subpoena, to the police. It's time for a change. It really is.
Really,
how many
is.
More people have to die? How many more women have to be sexually assaulted? I mean, really.
Well, you look at a lot of other occupations, and for far less misuse or misreporting, people are sued and criminally charged all the time. I mean, for a lot less. You know, if you work in a bar and you overserve somebody and they go out and kill somebody, you're prosecuted. I mean, there's a lot of cases of that sort of thing that you get prosecuted for.
That's a great point.
Yeah, why is this
medical?
But
I'll answer your question. Why? Because a bar is not a hospital, and a hospital has a lot of political power.
Yeah.
Columbia in Manhattan, one of the most prestigious hospitals in Manhattan, they have incredible political and financial power. You know, a bar owner, he can't go out and hire the very best law firms in the city to defend him. Oh, Columbia certainly could.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they have endowments of millions and millions of dollars. I remember one hospital I was working for in Manhattan, and they were trying to raise money for a department, and they said, oh, we need like another $1 million. And the fundraiser said, oh, that's not a problem. I can raise that for you in a week with a dinner. Like,
wow.
like nothing.
Wow.
Like it was nothing. And you know what? Oh, a lot of powerful people have their families go to these hospitals. Sometimes the hospitals have saved their lives. You know, sometimes the hospitals have just performed miracles for their families. And now you're asking them to prosecute the managers. It's politically very, very difficult.
Yeah.
Very difficult. And that's one of the reasons why it's never happened.
Yeah. Well, you know, you can't overlook the fact that hospitals do save thousands, I mean, millions of people. I mean, they treat people every day and cure them. And,
they did.
And, you know, do a lot of good. But,
of course.
Fellas, we're getting cut off by the news, but we're going to come back with our guest, Bruce Sackman. He's going to be here at the second hour. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Good afternoon. Welcome back to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pappy Machinery. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Go up and see them if you're looking for a John Deere, a mower, a tractor, implements, you name it. They've got it up there. They got a great inventory right now. They also do parts and service, and they're not that busy right now. If you want to run up there and get your mower tuned up or your tractor worked on, give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. Or go to the web and catch them at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da!
Yeah.
There you have it. All right, since there was so much falderol at the beginning of the first hour, no falderol this hour. Our guest is Bruce Sackman, and his book is super interesting. He also has a website, both same name, behindthemurdercurtain.com. And we have got all of his information posted and the other shows we've done with him. Today is December 3rd, 2023, and we appreciate you staying with us for another hour, Bruce, because honestly, we were talking about it in the break, and none of this can be done quickly.
No.
Like, you're a total story hour guy. And
Well, it's
even though the stories are terrifying, we love hearing you tell them.
Yeah, we were talking about the power that hospital lobbies have and the amount of money that they can raise, and that's part of the reason it's very difficult to prosecute hospitals. Because let's face it, I mean, doctor comes in, he's got the white suit on. I mean, you have to believe him that he's doing the right thing for your health. And I would hope to think that 99.9% of the time they are doing the right thing or the best of their ability to get you fixed up and out of there. Nobody wants to be in a hospital, but you do have the bad eggs. And that's where it just seems like somebody needs to be liable for bad actors. And it sounds like a lot of this just gets swept under the rug.
Well, look, of course 99.9% of the time they're doing the right thing. I mean, look, in all my years working in the hospital, I can tell you that the overwhelming majority of healthcare professionals are the most honest, hardworking, dedicated, compassionate people I have ever met.
Absolutely.
And if it wasn't for these people, I would have never been able to successfully weed out the bad guys, because I wouldn't even know about them if they didn't come forward and talk to me about it. But, you know, if you think about it, if you're so inclined to either commit a murder or even a sexual assault, I mean, what profession might you choose and what location might you choose? You know, you want to work with a group of people. Look, if you want to kill people, if you join the mafia or if you join some outlaw motorcycle gang, well, that's the first place we're going to look for you. But if you're so inclined to kill people or to even sexually assault women, I mean, the last place we're probably going to look for you is a hospital, because to me, a hospital has always been, well, a sanctuary from crime, right?
Exactly.
You don't go to the hospital to first become a victim of a crime.
Mm-hmm.
You go to the hospital after you've been a victim of a crime to heal.
Well, and also you don't know the profession. You don't know the technical aspects of being a doctor, the drugs, the side effects, I mean, the procedures. It's all stuff that is totally foreign to most people, and so you're putting your faith and you're depending on people that have the training to do and apply the right techniques. You don't know if they're right or wrong, so you have to trust them.
Yeah, even as I was looking up, I remembered we had a guy like that here in town, in Reading, and they didn't actually catch up with him until 2018, maybe a little bit. I think it went to court later than that. But he had victims back to 2005. And ultimately, he was a neurologist. 63 counts of sexually assaulting female patients. 63.
Yeah, you know, there are a number of these cases ongoing right now. I can tell you right now, just in the city of New York. There's a case involving a doctor by the name of Darius Paddock, a urologist, who was affiliated with multiple prominent academic medical centers in New York, and he was charged with sexually abusing patients, including minors, for years. There's a gastroenterologist, his name is Dr. Cheng, is charged with sexually assaulting unconscious patients and filming them at New York Presbyterian Queens Hospital, as well as assaulting other women at his home. I mean, both doctors, if convicted, could spend a lifetime in prison.
Oh, and yeah.
I know at Harvard, there's a doctor, there's a Derek Todd, a rheumatologist who worked at Harvard's Brigham and Women's Hospital, and he's been accused of more than 100 women of performing unnecessary or inappropriate breast, pelvic, and rectal exams. Hello, management. Are you listening out there? You know, when did you know, and what did you know when? These are questions I think we have a right to know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is just cases in this area, and I'm sure there are cases like this going on all over the country. And, you know, I frequently get asked this question, whether it be doctors who allegedly perform sexual assault or murder patients, they say, do people enter the profession because they want to commit these crimes and get away with it? And my answer is, based on my own 30 years' experience of doing these cases, for the most part, no. However, I think there are a couple of outliers. I believe that this one Dr. Haddon that we spoke about, who sexually assaulted 250 patients at Columbia, I believe that he became an OBGYN because he saw that as an opportunity to sexually assault patients.
Which is
so
hard, I mean, to comprehend that, because you look at the training and the schooling and the expense of becoming a doctor, and to have that in the back of your mind, hey, I'm going to be in a prime position to abuse people.
I always wonder, is it just the access that overwhelms maybe somebody who has
turn into that after the fact, but why would you? It just seems like a lot of expense and work goes into becoming a doctor, and then to turn, that's just hard to understand.
Hey, Bruce, you mentioned the nurses being vilified for coming forward and blowing the whistle on medical professionals. You'd said that even if they blew the whistle on another nurse, it still went poorly. Do doctors come forward? I'm assuming they do. But
Oh yes. No.
Does that have more horsepower when another doctor comes forward? Or?
You know what? You would think so, but I haven't seen any examples of that. I think management will poo-poo them just as quickly as they would a nurse.
Okay.
You know, I could think of two doctors that came forth in the Richard Williams case in Columbia, Missouri. I mean, management just jumped all over them. And these were two prominent physicians because the manager, you know, was concerned about his own reputation and the reputation of the hospital. And he just poo-pooed whatever these doctors said. And in that particular case, it was doctors that came forward. So around the world, it's kind of a mix. I would say maybe more nurses have come forward than physicians, but a lot of physicians have come forward as well. So there's courage from both professions.
Yeah, I mean, look at the doctors that have come forward and kind of raised the alarm on the vaccine issue, and they've been just totally vilified.
Oh. Yeah, that hasn't gone well
for going against the system, and now looking back, it's like, well, you know, they might not.
Interesting,
have been
the
wrong.
Statistics have kind of borne that out. Yeah.
Yes. And didn't your state even have a law that kind of prevented them from saying any negative thing about it?
They tried.
The vaccine?
Yeah, they did. They ran a bill that didn't ultimately go through. But, yeah, the idea was that if you spoke up against the vaccine, that I think it also involved promoting any sort of, you know, holistic treatments or alternative things that they didn't, you know, that didn't include the shot. If you did that they could take your medical license, and at that point it was like, okay, that's not going to work. But they tried.
Yeah. So it's very tough, you know, it's very, very tough to blow the whistle. I mean, it's tough in other professions as well, but it's particularly tough here. And what kind of separates this from, I think, in other professions is that your coworkers actually, and sometimes honestly, refuse to believe that a person who has taken an oath to save lives is intentionally taking lives.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they just find it very, very hard to believe. And they will search for explanations. You know, maybe the patients were extraordinarily sick. Maybe this nurse had more of the sickest patients than anyone else on the staff, which is fine. You know, they will search for legitimate reasons. But, you know, especially when you work with someone, sometimes for many, many years, it's very, very tough to accept the fact that that person that sometimes you've had dinner with, sometimes you've gone to their home,
mm-hmm.
and now all of a sudden they're accused of hurting people. You know, I had a case at the VA where a VA attorney, had embezzled the funds from incompetent veterans. You know, these incompetent veterans, they had special accounts set aside because they couldn't handle their own money. And this VA attorney who was responsible for monitoring these accounts actually helped himself to the money and took the money.
Wow.
And he got prosecuted. And when I went to his boss and laid out the case for his boss refused to believe it. He said, I've worked with this guy for many, many years. He's been to my home. I trust him. I can't really believe this is happening. And he wouldn't believe it until the day we went to federal court. And this lawyer admitted in front of court that he had embezzled the money from funds from incompetent veterans. Until that time, his boss refused to believe it.
Wow.
Now, I remember when I was working in the private sector, a number of small practices were bought out by the hospitals. They were taken over by the hospitals because it was very difficult for small practices to exist by themselves. And what we would do is we would go in and we would do audits of the practice. And lo and behold, we would discover that the practice manager had been stealing money from the physicians for years.
Uh-huh.
And unbeknownst to them, of course.
Hmm.
And when we laid it out to them, often they refused to believe it. They said, are you kidding me? This woman has been here for 10 years. She knows my family. She babysits for my kids. She wouldn't do anything like that. And sometimes people have a very tough time believing that their coworkers, particularly in a healthcare setting, where people have taken the Hippocratic Oath or Florence Nightingale Oath to save lives, is intentionally taking lives. It's very, very hard. Very, very hard to believe.
When you're in, you know, you get the case. There's been allegations, and you're investigating. Do you find that the people that you interview are typically cooperative, or are they like, do they kind of steer away from you and not really want to talk to you?
Well, I would say it's kind of a mixed bag, you know.
Depends on how guilty they are.
we get people that are very afraid.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so we have to spend a lot of time putting their mind at ease as best we can. They're very, very afraid to talk. And there are others, once in a few, you know, you get a few bold people who come right out and they'll tell you exactly how they feel. But there are other people that are really afraid to say anything. They'll run to their union rep, you know. I want to have my union rep here. And but you're not in trouble. You're not being accused of anything. I don't care. I want to have my union rep. I'm afraid for my job. Okay, bring your union rep. Bring your grandma. I don't care who you bring with you. You know, but we're going to have to talk. We're going to have this discussion. And then at first, you know, they're afraid to answer. They, like, answer yes, no, you know. But then after a while, and this is takes a lot of oral surgery, but after a while, they start to disclose exactly what they feel. But it's not easy for some, and then for others, they don't stop talking.
Yeah.
Keep on going. You know,
I knew it.
I've run into both. Yeah.
Well, you would think most people, when they come forward, you know, they've thought about it for a long time, and, you know, they've decided to pull the trigger on that. And I feel the worst for those folks, because then when the system says, oh, we're not going to do anything, I mean, that just winds up being incomprehensible for people. We have to take another quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Bruce Sackman. He has a website that I think you should go check out. It is behindthemurdercurtain.com, and you can find all of that on our site at wethepeopleradio.us.
Pretty frightening, but you know the chances are so small. Stuck by a bee sting, nothing but a bee thing. Better chance you're gonna buy it at the mall. But it's a 23 or 4 to 1 that you can fall in love by the end of this song. So get up, tell the bookie put a bet on not a damn thing will go wrong. The odds are that we will probably be alright. Odds are we gonna be alright. Odds are we gonna be alright tonight. The odds are that we will probably be alright. Odds are we gonna be alright. Odds are we gonna be alright.
Can you confirm those odds, Mr. Sackman?
Are we gonna be alright?
What are the odds?
Yeah, we're gonna be fine. You know, by the way, about 2 weeks ago, there was a case in the newspaper, I don't know if you guys caught it, about a nurse in Pennsylvania who confessed to killing 19 patients with insulin. Did you happen to see that one?
No.
All
right, her name is Heather Presti, Presstee. And people were so shocked by this, and they asked some of these questions. The prosecutor said, he said, this is one of the worst cases we have seen, with someone in the healthcare system going from facility to facility and unfortunately admitting to killing multiple people. No, it's not. We've seen this all over the world, Mr. Prosecutor. No, it is not. The family wants to know how Ms. Presti managed to work at 11 rehabilitation facilities over 5 years and kill people.
Oh, wow.
This is like a couple of weeks ago, right? According to a lawsuit, the staff members at the center began to notice that Ms. Presti was exhibiting, quote, troubling behavior, and that the health of the patients in her care would unexpectedly deteriorate. Yeah? And did so? What happened? Several staff members, the lawsuit states, began referring to her as the killer nurse while she's still working there. While she's still working there. Witnesses told investigators, according to the complaint, that Ms. Presti denigrated people in her care and made comments such as, when is she going to die already? Okay.
Wow.
And, you know, the prosecutor said in their news release that Ms. Presti had usually administered the insulin during overnight shifts when staff was low. because most of my medical serial killers love to work, pardon the pun, that 3 a.m., oh, what do they call it again? The 3 a.m. shift.
The graveyard.
All right. The graveyard shift. All right. And so, you see, all these things here, we've seen these many times before. This isn't new. These are red flags. It's enough already. Time to stop. Am I going to read about another one of these cases in another month or two from now? Yeah, I can tell you there's a couple of them ongoing right now as we speak. All right. There's a couple of cases ongoing, and they're associated with the COVID. Because if you remember during COVID, patients, the hospitals did not allow their families to come visit them. So that gave people an opportunity. Boy, you didn't even have to wait for the graveyard shift then because the families weren't allowed in the hospital during COVID. And there's a case ongoing right now in Canada. All right? Right now in Canada, the doctor's name is Dr. Brian Nadler. He's accused of killing 4 patients during COVID. And there's also a case in Germany ongoing where a doctor's accused of killing patients during COVID because as easy as it was to kill patients in a hospital regularly, during COVID, it was even that much easier. All right.
Oh, yeah. I bet. Nobody could visit anybody.
That's right.
Hospitals were empty.
So that's what's ongoing right now, you know, in the world of medical serial killers. And every couple of weeks, a new one surfaces somewhere, and the story's the same. You know, they work the midnight, that they work the graveyard shift. People suspected them of killing something, killing patients. Every time this nurse is on duty, the death rate goes up. The nurse takes a vacation, the death rate goes down. The patients were not expected to expire when they did. They're all the same stories. The sad thing is the stories keep continuing and keep coming, and it's about time it stopped.
Yeah, and so if you were going to make some sort of a change, what would that look like to prevent this?
There are a number of things I would do. Talked about some of it before, but I would talk about changing the law to make it easier for prosecutors to prosecute those managers that truly aid and abet these medical serial killers or these physicians who commit numerous sexual assaults against patients. That's the first thing. The second thing I would do is make it easier for the whistleblowers. I would give financial incentives to them so when the hospital is fined, the whistleblower can receive a percentage of that fine or penalty against the hospital, and that would give them a financial incentive to come forward. Plus, it would cover their legal fees as well. Then it's a matter of training, all right? You have to train the staff on the red flags on how to identify these people, because as I showed you, the cases are very similar all around the world. That last case we went through, a number of red flags existed in that case, but nothing happened. So it's a matter of training as well. Training to say, and that's something that I've done. I mean, I've gone around to a lot of healthcare organizations, and I talk about the red flags, and I do all the training that I can for them. And you know something interesting? When I address these medical professionals, and they're a wonderful audience, and they're all very interested, and they're very concerned, inevitably, someone will come up to me after my presentation and say, you know, Bruce, we had this doctor who worked here. We had this nurse who worked here. And we just kind of suspected something. We thought something was going on. We thought he may have been intentionally harming people, but, you know, we couldn't really prove it, and we talked about it, and then he moved on to another hospital, so we just forgot about it. You don't know how many times I've been approached by people telling me that same story. Is that scary or what?
Yeah. Terrifying.
It really is.
And then, do they, do you find that these people, I would imagine once they carve themselves a niche, they stay there, but the smart thing to do would be to move around. Do they carve the niche or move around?
Well, you know what? It depends. Some of them move around. I would say some of them are kind of forced to move around because the management makes it uncomfortable for them, but gives them an option, you know, whether they're going to pursue the matter or they'll find another job. So, of course, they find another job. As a nurse, Colin worked in about 10 different hospitals. Many of those hospitals suspected something. Never called the police. Never even cooperated with the police once he was charged. And he moved around to 10 hospitals. Niles Hogel in Germany moved around the hospital. So,
Swango, you know, Swango was in a different country, wasn't he?
Yes. Swango was actually in Zimbabwe, Africa, where he killed women and children and pregnant women and poisoned his landlady. And just went on and on and on until he had to return to the United States, and eventually he was successfully prosecuted here. But these cases, from an investigative standpoint, take a lot of time and a lot of money, something that a lot of local police departments don't have. First of all, well, most cops don't become cops because they're good in chemistry and biology. So they're very, very dependent on the doctors. They don't want to go in the hospital. They don't want to do investigations in the hospital. You know, they have this HIPAA law, this Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. What records can I get with a subpoena? What records do I need a court order for? Does the judge have to sign it? Do they have to give me everything? Are there some things they don't have to give me? And I don't understand the science. I mean, I don't understand what could have harmed these people. And lastly, the management is telling the officer this. The officer shows up and the management is saying, thank you very much, officer, for your concern. You know, we were just as concerned as you are here at the hospital. So we did our own internal investigation. You know, we put together a board of our very best doctors and nurses, and they reviewed the cases. And we came to the conclusion that all the patients expired as a direct result of their natural disease processes. Now, if you want to continue that investigation, officer, knock yourself out. But this is the conclusion we've come to. So how many police departments, particularly smaller police departments, are just going to say, thank you very much, Mr. Hospital President, and close the case and go on to something else? And that's another reason why so many medical serial killers get away with murdering so many patients.
Yeah,
well, it would, because you look at an investigation like that, and if you're not a specialist in any of that, I mean, you have investigated these cases. How much expertise did you have to amass before you were kind of conversant in all that? When you start looking, like...
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, okay, there's just a different lingo. Everything is...
Because what I'm thinking of is I did have a situation where I had some people come to me, and it was about a facility that had seniors. And they said, well, there were tons of medication errors, thousands of medication errors. Now, I'm thinking that means they're giving the wrong medication to people. But there's a huge range of things that qualify as a medication error, and I thought the farther I got into it, the more I realized I don't know what's good, what's bad. If I even looked at the records, would I know what I was looking at?
Well, those are excellent points, and that's why it requires a team of people to do these cases. All right, when we did the Swango case, I had never done any homicide case before in my life. I had done every other conceivable crime that could occur in a hospital, but I didn't do a homicide case. But fortunately for me, I met up with a forensic pathologist named Dr. Michael Bodden. Michael Bodden has been on TV many times. He has a show called Autopsy. And I said, how do we do this, Doc? And he says, well, this is what we're going to do, and this is what we did with Swango. He says, first thing we're going to do is assemble a team. And this team is going to consist of himself as a forensic pathologist and my group as investigators. But also, we need a physician who's expert on chart review. He could look at a patient's chart and make a determination as to whether or not that patient should have expired when he did.
Mm.
Right. Also, what we gathered up was a group at that time, a relatively new profession, known as forensic nursing. Forensic nurses were phenomenal. These are nurses that are trained in both forensic science and nursing science. And they had a great idea of everything that was going on, including the hospital administration and the science. And they could kind of dumb down the science to lay people like myself so we could actually get a pretty good idea of what was going on. And lastly, you know, we needed a toxicologist, somebody to make a determination as to whether these people were poisoned, and if so, what the poisons were. So, you know, I don't care if you're the reincarnation of Sherlock Holmes. One investigator cannot do this case by him or herself. It literally takes not only a team of people, but it takes a load of money, a load of resources to do this. And unless you have a team, and unless you're this team is well-financed, you're going to lose.
So when you say it takes a lot of money, is that to pay the people that are involved in the investigation?
In part, but it's also to sometimes pay for external lab work.
Oh,
you know, in the case of Swango, the FBI declined to do our toxicology for us, okay? Because they had done a somewhat similar case, and they were unsuccessful, and they didn't want to touch it. So we had to go to the largest private civilian forensic lab in the country, the Reader's Lab in Pennsylvania, and it cost us like $100,000 in lab fees.
Yeah.
How many police departments have that kind of money?
Yeah.
They drop $100,000 on lab fees. And then you're talking about bringing people in and paying for their hotels, sometimes for months and months at a time. It's a very expensive proposition.
Sure.
All right. Now, in the federal government, well, you know, money's no object. But if you're in a local police department and you got a tight budget, you're going to look for a reason not to do these cases.
Mm, or hand it off to
many
somebody.
Many parts of the world.
Yeah,
you're not working with other people's money. Well, with the VA, how much? Darn it! We have to take a really quick break again. Fooey. All right, when we come back, I'm asking you about the VA because I got questions.
Sure.
So many questions. So let's see. Our guest here is Bruce Sackman, and talking about murder. Nice little break from politics. You go from politics to murder, back to politics. You know what the heck? Why not? You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at
WeThePeopleRadio.us.
And we take them out and show ourselves when everyone has gone. Some are satin, some are steel, some are silk and some are leather. They're the faces of the stranger, but we love to try them on. You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay. Good.
Or Bruce Sackman puts him in jail. Okay, so with the different things at VA, not just hospitals and clinics, but you also have VA, you have veterans' homes.
Yes, we have what we call extended care centers. Yes.
Because out here we've got Yountville, and, you know, we have some big ones. We have one here in Reading, and those are run by CalVet. Those are state. They're not VA, but...
Yes, there are state-run homes, and there are federal homes. The state-run homes in New York and Connecticut had terrible, terrible COVID-related problems. Mm. I don't know about out in California, but in New York, many, many veterans expired at these state-run veterans' homes unnecessarily. In fact, there was a big Justice Department investigation. They said it was so bad that the veterans' civil rights were actually violated in the homes during COVID. But did any manager get prosecuted? Well, we know the answer. We don't even have to ask that anymore. We know the answer to that. All right. Many, many deaths in Connecticut and in New Jersey in the state-run homes. Terrible, terrible.
And and why do you think that that is? How do you find the accountability there? How is that working?
You know, because it was a state home, I never actually had the opportunity to go into a state home or to do an investigation in a state home, because it didn't really fall under my purview. But I could tell you that I recall one time going into the VA, the Federal Extended Care Center, in Queens, and it was not pretty. It was not a pretty sight, and we helped clean that place up. But, you know, the thing is about nursing homes and extended care centers, many times the residents there, they don't really get visited by their families much, so there's really not much pressure on the staff to do the right thing, and sometimes things just kind of slip away, and the next thing you know, especially during a pandemic, if it's not done properly, people are going to die. And that's what happened to a terrible extent in New Jersey and in Connecticut.
Yeah, and that was kind of a, I remember we did a show with a researcher out of Canada where they were moving a lot of the COVID patients to rest homes. Basically putting COVID in all those different places. They moved a handful of them into like 40 different rest homes instead of grouping them together and taking care of it. So I think there were a lot of things that went on. I don't know if we're ever going to get to the bottom of that 2020 and
all the
things.
I can tell you that the states were sued and the states had to pay out a lot of money, and that's kind of the routine in these things. You know, the state gets sued or the government gets sued and they pay out a lot of money, but nobody actually gets charged or even loses their job usually at all.
Interesting. And do you find that with the private hospitals versus, like, say, VA facilities, you know, federal facilities, because you've investigated both, is the... because you already laid out for us, like, the management issues. Like, if, you know, if we bring this to light, then everyone's going to think our facility is terrible, you know, that kind of thing. Is it the same in both, or do you notice any difference? Is that just a medical facility issue, or does it matter what system you're in?
You know, I don't have enough experience with the extended care centers. My experience was very, very limited with the nursing homes, with the extended care centers. So I don't want to say anything that I'm not 100% positive about.
How about in the actual hospitals, like VA hospital versus, you know, regular, you know, public hospital?
You know, there are some great VA hospitals, and there are some not-so-great VA hospitals. Remember, there are over 100 VA hospitals.
Right.
They're not all created equal. In fact, not every department on every floor is created equal. I mean, you could have an outstanding department on the third floor and a lousy department on the fourth floor. But I would say that most veterans are satisfied with the treatment that they receive at the VA. That doesn't mean there aren't plenty of horror stories. I mean, real horror stories. But given that it's over 100 hospitals, any hospital system, whether it be private or public, with over 100 hospitals, you're going to have some really serious problems. And
sure.
That's just the way it is.
Well, and then with, you know, between Obamacare and COVID and all that stuff, we have really reduced the number of physicians out there in all capacities, you know, whether they're GPs or neurologists or whatever. So I guess what I'm percolating in the back of my mind is that that fuels opportunity for, bad things, maybe.
I was just reminded, you know, about in Jersey, when the DOJ came out their report, and they did a report, I think, jointly with the state. They quoted a worker from one of the homes as describing it as pure hell.
Yikes.
This is a worker. And Menlo Park in New Jersey as a battlefield. And the report said that the home's dysfunctional management style and poor communications contributed to staffing shortages, I'm reading from the report, limiting their ability to keep residents safe. At Menlo Park, staff members feared retaliation. At both homes, Veterans Affairs leaders often appeared indifferent and even hostile to employees' concerns.
Mm. Wow.
Doesn't this sound repetitive already?
Yeah. Well, there is really a pattern. So if you... All right, so from a useful standpoint, so we realize there's a very, you know, finite, small, and small number of doctors. There's a larger pool, but still small number of nurses. But there are tons of patients and a zillion family members and friends of patients. So it seems like we would be... You know, all of us would be kind of a great resource. How would you smarten up the public as both patients and friends of patients on what to do?
Well, this is what I'll tell members of my own family or people that I discuss this with. It's very important when going into some sort of medical center institution that the patient is not by themselves, that the patient actually has an advocate with them, a family member who politely and respectfully asks questions and takes notes. Because, look, if I'm inclined to harm a patient or do something bad, I'm not going to do something when the family's there asking questions and taking notes, okay? I'm going to go on to the next person who maybe never gets a visit, and this happens a lot in our veterans' homes, you know, families never come visit them. There are poor vets who sit there and they haven't seen their families in years. That's who I'm going to pick on, because nobody's going to complain.
Nobody's going to notice.
Easy target.
That's right. I'm not going to pick on somebody that has a really sharp family member there asking questions, and I'm not saying to interfere or, you know, to be a pain in the ass. But what I'm saying is to politely and respectfully make your presence known and take notes and ask questions. And that's the best thing you could do to keep your family member safe.
Yeah, and just really pay attention. How many of these, some of these people, like the nurse that confessed after how many years? How many years was she was... killing people?
Well, there are many, many, many different nurses. I don't know which one you're talking about. But
I'm thinking of the last one you spoke about.
Yeah, the last one. Let me see. I think the last one.
This was like a lot of years.
I thought he said it was like 10 years.
Since 2018.
Okay.
Since 2018. Okay. So, you know, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. Yeah.
So you're a hospital, you know, you're working in a hospital or some facility or whatever, and you have patients die on your watch. Now that happens anyway, because
of course
not everybody who goes in comes out. Like, and that's legit.
Right.
That happens.
Right. That's
so
right.
I mean, that's not always an indicator either, right?
Well, no, but it seems like every time Nurse Erin is on duty, the death rate goes up. Nurse Aaron takes a vacation, the death rate goes down. But you know what's interesting about Nurse Aaron's patients?
They have a great time while they're in there? Oh, no, that's not...
No, they weren't expected to expire when they did. In fact, many times they were actually improving, and the family would come visit them and say, oh, I could go on vacation now, only to get a call from Nurse Aaron saying that their dad or mom passed unexpectedly.
Uh-huh.
That's a big difference.
That is
because,
big difference.
You know, if you've ever had a loved one that's really, really ill in the hospital, maybe near death, you knew they were near death, the staff knew, their death didn't come as a real shock to anyone, all right? But these are people that weren't expected to expire. In fact, many times they're actually improving. And that's the big difference.
So you're a family member of somebody that fits that scenario, and that evil Nurse Aaron gets their grip on them. And then suddenly they're no longer going on vacation. They are not coming home at all. You start asking questions, but again, you're not an expert and you're not the police. And how do you get somebody interested in looking into it? If you have...
Well, that's usually where the civil side comes. You know, that's when many of these cases actually start as a result of a civil suit, where the family actually sues the hospital, gets a hold of a malpractice attorney and a private investigator, and then the information comes out, and that turns into a government criminal case.
Mm.
So many times, and I think that was the case in Pennsylvania here as well, it started out as a civil case. And, you know, it's actually easier to make a civil case than a criminal case because the burden of proof is different. In a civil case, you only have to prove 51% of the evidence, what they call a preponderance of the evidence, where in a criminal case, it's beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's a much higher burden.
And do they typically go after the doctor, or do they go after the management?
Well, they'll go after everyone, but this is only for monetary damages.
Sure.
Right.
So they'll go after everyone. But in the case of Richard Williams at the VA Medical Center, when the FBI and the VA came to the conclusion that they cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Richard Williams had murdered patients, the family sued, and the family won. And the judge said, in his opinion, Richard Williams did murder these patients. However, there wasn't enough evidence to convince the jury beyond a reasonable doubt. But as far as civil proof goes, that 51% of the evidence did exist. So many times the cases either go that route, or they start that route and then morph into a criminal case.
If they get, I know we're running out of time here. If they get convicted on a civil case, that doesn't typically remove them from the system. But I would think that their malpractice insurance would probably drop if they have a giant claim against them. Do you find that to be the case?
No, I actually find that these doctors usually pick up and find another hospital to work with. And, they may have to pay a little more, but even the medical boards don't usually go after these people. So,
wow.
No, they just continue.
So it's kind of all about staying healthy and paying attention.
That's certainly
in
helpful.
That order. Well, I think we'll have to sign off with you today, Bruce. Thank you so much for coming on with us again. We love hearing your stories, although they're terrifying. And if you missed the beginning of the show, you should definitely catch it on the archive at
wethepeopleradio.us.
I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't.